the volume. Can you hear me in the back? Raise your hand if you can hear me in the back. Can you hear me now? No? In the back? No. How about now? Is that better? No? It is on. Can you hear me? No? Can you hear me? Okay, good. It was on mute. Is that too loud now? That's good? Okay, good. Iowa. Trying to adjust the lighting. That appears to be as low as it goes. Can everybody see the screen okay? Yeah, okay, good. Okay, good. We're not trying to shake you. I'm sorry about all the venue changes. This is just a function of overbookings within the university as a whole. It looks like most of you are here, so you've found us. This is where we'll be regularly meeting for Monday lectures from here on out, so we won't be meeting in George Square Lecture Theater from here on. This week we'll be covering microclimate modification, and I'm not gonna provide a definition for that yet, because I'll get to it in a moment. What I wanted to do first is just give you a lay of the land for tomorrow's tutorials, because we're gonna complete a number of tasks that involve you to bring in a few things in advance. We'll be meeting in two groups, so rather than meeting with all of you at once like we did last week, we'll meet with groups 4 to 7, and those numbers are based on your unit allocations in Architectural Design 2. So do those numbers mean anything to you? Yeah, okay. So those of you that are in groups 4 to 7 will meet tomorrow from 2 to 3:15, and those of you that are in groups 1 to 3 will meet between 3:30 and 4:45 in the Hugh Robson Building Lecture Theater. What we're gonna do tomorrow is look at a number of different techniques for tracking sun and wind on site. And they're gonna range from analog techniques using physical models to drawing techniques to digital modeling techniques. In order to do that, I'm just going to ask you to bring a couple of things in. One is a model and a stereographic chart. Now, a model, you probably don't have models handy. This is just an image giving you a sense of what I mean by that. This is a physical model indicating a very small building on a large site, and this is a stereographic sun chart. In order to physically map shadows on site, you need both. You probably don't have a site model handy at this point, but really all you need is anything that can serve as a site or a flat base with something that can serve as a building of some sort. So if you can just take a piece of cardboard, put a few blocks of wood or cardboard or something on it to simulate a site model, that will be helpful. Then also print out this diagram. I'll send you an email via Learn after this class with an attachment. Just print that out, mount it to something rigid, a piece of cardboard, and be sure to attach a gnomon. What I mean by that is there's a little thing here that says peg length, and what you need to do is find some kind of fine material like a thin piece of balsa or a straight pin, the finer the better. Cut it to that length and affix it to the model at this point here.
Or a matchstick.
Base of a matchstick. So you'll have your gnomon attached to the sun chart, and the length needs to be exactly as indicated on that chart. So if you can bring those things with you tomorrow. Also bring a flashlight. I'd like to be optimistic and think we'll be able to take these outside and actually simulate them in actual sunlight. when we were lucky enough last year to have direct light, but I'm suspicious. So do bring a flashlight or a torch if you have one, because we can simulate the same conditions using a torch. And then finally, if you do have a laptop and you either do or don't have SketchUp, if you don't have SketchUp, you can download it for free. But if you have a laptop, bring it with you with SketchUp downloaded. And I will also send through a digital model, if you can just have that saved to your desktop so that you can use it as we go through a tutorial for tracking shadows. How many of you are familiar with using SketchUp? How many of you are not? Okay, so I just learned SketchUp. Well, I didn't learn SketchUp. I learned how to use Jillian's tutorial of SketchUp yesterday. So I'm probably gonna ask one of you to help me with this task tomorrow. It's very straightforward. How many of you have used the shadow tracking feature? Okay, so it'll be new for the majority of you. It's quite straightforward, but it's worth showing you nonetheless. So that's what we'll be doing tomorrow during tutorials. Just a note about references. There are a number of, my pointer is just giving away, here we go. There are a number of required readings that will be uploaded. It says, sorry, WebCT, uploaded to Learn. Take a look at those because they do go into more detail than I'll be able to today. They're quite short, they're 5 or 8 pages. They'll be quite useful in particular for assignment 1 coursework. So take a look at those, and then there's a couple of other suggested readings that again will be on course reserve in the library. So before we talk about microclimate modification by design, it's important just to get a handle on some very basic definitions. This is all natural science stuff that you guys probably studied, you know, 8 or 10 years ago. But just as a reminder, atmosphere is basically the gaseous bubble that surrounds the Earth. It's constantly in motion, the Earth is rotating, and it's this differential between the motions of the Earth and the motions of this gaseous bubble that are informed by sunlight that creates particular weather conditions over time. The basic difference between weather and climate, as you know, has to do with temporality. Weather tells us the instantaneous conditions of the atmosphere at any given single time. Those conditions are described by temperature, moisture, wind, pressure, and radiation. Meteorology is obviously the science of those instantaneous conditions. And climate gives a sense of those conditions over time. And it's important that we think about these generalized conditions over time rather than any specific single moment in time, because that gives us a sense of general tendencies that we can design for with more precision. Looking at weather at any single moment in time may be aberrant from the prevailing conditions, and therefore it's less useful to us. So weather and climate, the distinctions have to do with time. Micrometeorology versus meteorology and microclimatology versus versus climatology really just have to do with scales of observation. So when we talk about micrometeorology, we're talking about weather conditions at a specific moment in time within a small area. And when we talk about microclimatology, we're talking about specific climatic conditions over a finite area. When we talk about climate scales generally, we talk about them again in terms of spatial scales of observation as either micro, meso, or macro, meso, or micro conditions. Macro conditions have to do with larger spatial conditions, such as whether a city is coastal or not, whether there are large topographic conditions that might impact wind flow. And those tend to be tied to regions. So Southeast Scotland, for example, would be a kind of macro climate condition. Mesoclimate has to do with more focused prevailing conditions. A local example would be, how does weather behave on the entire University of Edinburgh campus, for example, or within downtown Edinburgh, which again would be impacted by topography, water, etc. And the microclimate conditions have to do with even finer scales. They generally have to do with the most adjacent buildings, vegetation, et cetera, to a particular site. And those are the kinds of conditions we're most interested in because of their they're dealing with local conditions that will directly impact how you design buildings on a site. Here are two resources for climate data that will be useful for you, particularly for assignment two. General climate data is included on this site here. All of the annual and monthly averages for temperature, humidity, wind speed, et cetera. And then just for your information, a kind of macro explanation for climate in eastern Scotland is on this website as well. So that might be of interest to you. This is familiar to you. What we know, you probably know, I mean, just by looking at this, where points would be plotted on this thermal comfort chart for Edinburgh. So just to give you a sense of things, intuitively you should know where these points will fall. I mean, where do you think they'll fall on this chart? Will they be around here? Which quadrant of this? Upper left, upper right, lower left, do you think most of the prevailing climate conditions of Edinburgh will fall?
Lower left.
Anybody think otherwise? Yeah. What do you think?
Lower right.
Lower right, you're right. So it's lower right because we are actually, Edinburgh has quite high humidity levels. So we have low temperatures year round. Temperatures range from somewhere between 5 degrees Celsius to 15, or 3 rather in January. The average is 3 in January, 15 in July. So we have conditions that are ranging from, you know, down here to up here. And the humidity year-round is somewhere between 70 and 85%. So we're falling somewhere around here most of the year. And what that means is that if we have a point that's plotted here, we need to know radiation levels in order to know whether we'll fall within that thermal comfort bubble. So what are the radiation levels of Edinburgh? This gives a general sense in comparison to London of watts, incident solar radiation in watts per meter squared. And what we're looking at here is that that value somewhere, Edinburgh's green, between 20 watts per meter squared in January up to 180. So if we go back to that thermal comfort chart, 180 is way up here. So what percentage of the year do you think you're falling outside of that thermal comfort zone? Just a guess. How much? 60, 70, 80, 90? Probably about 80 or 90%, okay? So we're out off the charts here. Most of the year, we're gonna be quite cold. Other climate bits of information you already know, it rains a lot. We get approximately 300 days of rain a year here in Edinburgh. Lovely weather. I brought this up just to answer a question that came up last tutorial about this zone. So people were asking, what happens if wind speed's higher than that, but lower than this? Probable heat stroke. And the reason that this is particularly confusing is just because of the this is a good lesson in graphic technique. It's very deceptive that they've used a green line here because it implies that it's an extension of that thermal comfort bubble, but in fact it's not. This diagram might be a little bit clearer. This is directly from Olguier's. He's the original source of that drawing, and you can see that beyond that line, the wind is just too strong, and particularly in a hot, arid climate zone, the temperature, air temperature is gonna be quite hot, and you can imagine someone holding a hairdryer to your face. It's not comfortable, right? So wind, more wind doesn't necessarily mean more comfortable. There is a limit of wind speed that's tolerable. So just to answer that question from last week. So here, just another graphic representation of thermal comfort conditions in Edinburgh. This is from IES, which is a piece of software that's primarily used by mechanical engineers to test interior thermal performance. It has climate data files, which are quite useful. And this is a climate data file for Edinburgh. And what we can see here is blue cold stress,
no, we have no hot stress ever. And 2 months of the year during the day, it's comfortable. So that's nice. This is just an important point to take on, because I think we talk about temperate climate zones, we talk about underheating and overheating being, you know, you have to temper both. But the reality is that the dominant concern pretty much year-round is underheating. I mentioned that before. Just because it's sort of interesting, this green line along the dial, basically that indicates how often the diurnal swing is less than 5 degrees Celsius. So over the course of 24 hours, which times of year is that swing quite large? And it only happens to occur here in November and December. Can anybody guess why that might be, going back to thinking back to Ola's lecture when she talked about there not being high diurnal swings in hot, humid climate zones? That's a good guess. Quite high up in latitude, not necessarily. Anybody else have any thoughts about why? What's that? Shorter days. What was your guess?
A lot of clouds.
That's part of it. Shorter days, not so much. High humidity. So the humidity levels are quite high year round, and that humidity retains heat. The cloud cover is another variable, because the radiation doesn't escape to the atmosphere. The clouds contain it. That's just some interesting facts about Edinburgh climate, and these will become important in particular for assignment two. Again, just to visualize things here, Edinburgh Airport, you can see this red bar indicates wind-sensible heating. This basically gives a sense of distribution of energy requirements towards either heating or cooling, depending on location. And obviously in Edinburgh, the dominant concern is heating. There's a little bit of humidification required. But if you look at places like, what climate zones would these be in? They require a lot of dehumidification. Which climate zone? Hot, humid, right. So Bangkok, Singapore, etc. And there are a lot of parallels here between other North American cities, although in places like Denver, Boston, Chicago, you do get the bigger temperature swings, and therefore more humidification is required, and also a bit of cooling is required in some of these other temperate climate zones. Okay, so we're gonna look at some specifics in terms of wind speed and directionality in particular. This is what's called a windrose. Have you guys seen a windrose? Okay, well, windrose basically graphically indicates direction and intensity of wind flow in a particular area. So what we see here is that the prevailing wind direction is from south-southwest, or west-southwest, rather. And we get a little bit of wind from the northeast. That wind, this is a bit confusing because you have a value here, it says 28.88, and yet this says something like 10 meters per second. What do you think that number is telling you? What's that? That it goes out of range? No, but thank you for trying. Anybody else? I'm trying to think of a way of making that a yes somehow creatively, but I can't. 28, what might that mean? What's that? A map? What did you say?
The max.
The max. Maximum speed, that's a good guess, but that's not it either. If you add, what's that? Yes, that's right, percentage. So it's percentage of the year that the wind direction is from that orientation. So it's a bit confusing. I just want to point that out so you don't read that as 28 meters per second. It's 28% of the time the wind is coming from that direction. You read this for speed generally. Okay, and this
I mentioned last week that height, it's important to take into account height. These wind speeds are taken at 10 meters per second, or excuse me, at 10 meters above ground. So what information does this not tell you? If you wanted to understand wind behavior over the course of the year, what else would you want to know?
When they occur.
That's right, when they occur. So what this doesn't tell us is what months of the year those prevailing directions are coming from. And that's where this diagram is useful, because it tells dominant wind direction per month. So what does this tell us? What's the dominant wind direction the vast majority of the year? Well, what the diagram said before. Okay, that was a bad question. What months is the prevailing direction not west southwest or southwest?
Yep, we have April, May, and June. Yep, so summer months, early summer months, late spring months, we do get some wind from northeast. And that's important when we do talk about microclimate modification, because you might want to block from that southwesterly wind, but perhaps encourage the northeasterly wind in the summer. Just another fun fact, Beaufort, what is that? Anybody heard of the Beaufort scale? It's a scale for measuring wind intensity. And it's interesting, I'm sort of including this not necessarily for your technology and environment knowledge, for the benefit of increasing your knowledge in this discipline, but for providing an example of a qualitative, quantitative mode of measure. So that's something that's probably come up in design. What's interesting about the Beaufort scale is that it's a way of quantifying wind by mapping wind conditions onto things that can be visually registered. So in this case, height of waves. In other cases, you often see the Beaufort scale talking about smoke, whether it's rising vertically or, you know, at an angle, versus how leaves are rustling in a tree. So it's an interesting mode of measure that ties both the qualitative or the experiential with a metric, a number, a value. Okay, so now you have a sense of the climate conditions of Edinburgh. You should have an understanding of what microclimate means, but here's a more concise definition. Microclimate is the condition of the solar and terrestrial radiation, wind, air temperature, humidity, and precipitation in a small outdoor space. Microclimates are the result of interaction between prevailing climate and objects in the landscape. So some of those variables are easily modified by the built environment, and others are more difficult. So which of these variables here can you control through design in terms of building location and orientation? And which ones would be more difficult to control without mechanical means? Yeah, wind can be easily controlled. What else? What's that? No, please answer.
I said
do you think that's easy to control or not?
I think it
it can be controlled mechanically, yes, but without mechanical means, would that be easy or hard? It would be difficult. Yes, it would be. So that falls into the category of a little bit more difficult to control. What else would be easy to mitigate? Yes, that's right. And what about precipitation? You can't not make it rain, but you can easily protect from rain. So that's something that you can easily account for. The things that are more difficult to account for are those things that are sort of tied to atmospheric conditions. So air temperature, humidity, because the atmosphere is such an efficient mixer, it would be very difficult to alter through, you know, the placement of windbreaks or things like that, air temperature per se, or humidity levels. There are always exceptions. So here, this is just a reiteration of that. These are variables that can be easily modified: wind, solar radiation, terrestrial radiation, which has to do with radiation that's emitted by materials on a site. So by selection of appropriate materials, you can affect
terrestrial radiation, we'll talk about that shortly, and precipitation. And these are the things that are more difficult to modify: air temperature and humidity. Okay, so this is an exception. There's always exceptions to these things. Pocket parks, which basically refer to small-scale urban parks that are often sandwiched between buildings in a dense urban environment. What you can't see from this photo is that there are quite tall buildings on either side of this. This is a plan that might give you a sense of that. Because there really is a sense of enclosure on three sides, the trees to a certain extent would contain atmospheric conditions. There's a water feature here that would cool by evaporative cooling. Because this space is so contained, it almost becomes fully enclosed. There can be modifications in terms of temperature and humidity. And this is similar to some of the things that we talked about last week in hot, arid climate zones and courtyards, where there might be an evaporative cooling element and trees that contain that cooled air. So there are always exceptions to these things. But in general, when we talk about microclimate modification, we're talking about wind and solar radiation, dealing with those two things. So how can we design well by taking microclimate modification into account, or how can microclimate modification impact the built environment? Any guesses? There's sort of three things that we can, by designing in a proactive way with regards to microclimate, we can achieve. Does anybody have any sense of what that might do? Why would we want to design in a way that's attuned to the microclimate conditions of a site? Yes, exactly. So that goes back to this active versus passive heating and cooling. So if you do orient your building effectively, you take advantage of these resources of radiation, blocking wind or allowing a certain amount of wind for ventilation, you can passively heat and cool a building. So that's one thing. Reduce CO2 emissions. That's related to the idea of using these resources to passively heat and cool. I'm going really slowly today, so I'm just going to cut right to the chase here and tell you the other two. One is to reduce damage to building fabrics. So there can be damage that's incurred by wind, snow, ice, etc., to the building fabric itself. And then the other thing that is probably not obvious is that you can extend seasonal use of exterior space if you do design in a way that's attuned to local microclimate conditions. And this is an example of that we'll see a week from tomorrow. We're going to visit the John Hope Gateway. This is an area just to the south. It's an exterior seating area. So now we know the prevailing wind direction, which is from where? Yeah, so we have wind coming like this here. We have sun that's doing something like that, moving across the way here. So what we have here is it's a outdoor seating space. What you can't see in the plan is that there's a wall that extends along this line. And that wall effectively blocks the wind. So you have a wind shadow, but you also have the solar radiation on that surface. So it effectively extends the amount of time that one can spend in relative comfort within Edinburgh. And here's another example of using microclimate modification almost in a poetic way. This is a project I'll maybe read it to you quickly. This is a project by Stoss Landscape Urbanism in the States. And this is a project that proposes an artificial winter microclimate. Well, I'll just maybe paraphrase this. Basically, what the project proposes is it acknowledges that this particular context, which is in Milwaukee, which is quite cold along a coastal area, a large part of the year is underutilized because the weather is so severe. So what the project proposes is to create an altered microclimate. And they propose to do that by growing vegetation that was non-native, bamboo, using low energy source pumps to create heated mist from the adjacent water into these sort of atmospheric clouds, which obviously would be heated and would alter the local conditions of the climate itself. Now that utilizes energy, so it's not necessarily a passive strategy, but it's a way of thinking about how local modifications to climate can alter or extend the amount of time in which you are effectively comfortable in that exterior environment. Okay, so now I'm just going to quickly go through wind behavior and solar behavior, just so you have a sense of how these conditions, the general qualities of these conditions, so that you can design effectively with them. Three general points about wind. I've mentioned height, that wind is a sectional condition, it increases with height. Because of friction, which causes turbulence, air velocity is slower near the Earth's surface. Okay. Because of inertia, air tends to continue moving in the same direction when it meets an obstruction. And this is something that's obvious, but when you'll be in a situation where you have to draw how wind operates along a site, and you'd be surprised how many people show wind like reflecting off of surfaces and changing direction and all sorts of things. Wind flows, it's a fluid, so just remember that when you're drawing these conditions. And air moves from areas of high pressure to areas of low pressure, so obviously pressure is building up as the air hits the surface. This is the low pressure area, and effectively air moves from this high to low pressure, creating cross ventilation. So these are general principles of physics that are important to understand. And again, air is not water, obviously, but it is fluid, so it behaves as a fluid behaves. And tomorrow, for those of you that have iPhones, there's an app you can get. Which was it, Sally? Are you the one that? Who told me about this? Is it you? Wind Tunnel Pro. There's if you have an iPhone, do you have to pay for it? I have it. It's free. There's a free app called Wind Tunnel Pro. So if you have an iPhone, download it for tomorrow. We'll look at it quickly as well, because it's an application that shows you can draw obstructions on a surface, and it'll show you how wind flows around it. Okay, so bring that along with you tomorrow as well. A couple of other effects that it's worth knowing about. One is called the Venturi effect, and that basically takes place when wind is constricted by either a topographic condition or two buildings. When it's constricted, obviously, flow increases, and so you get a certain kind of intensity that occurs. This gives a good sense of that. These lines are called isobars, and when there are more of them, it means wind is faster. So you can see that wind is sort of forced between those two mounds. Same condition happens in an urban environment around buildings. And then vertical surfaces also affect wind flow and can be, in some cases, extreme with high-rise buildings. If a large face of a building is facing the prevailing wind direction, you get these vortex effects that happen when the wind hits the surface and is channeled to the ground surface, causing spiraling down drafts. And it's important to recognize, this is something that you'll talk about in when you work with Demetrius, that wind, of course, is a force that's acting on a building, and it's causing lateral loading. So we often think about gravitational loads, other loads on buildings happening vertically. Wind would be an example of a lateral load, as would seismic activity, earthquakes. So you have to design with that in mind, because wind can exert an enormous amount of pressure on a surface. And of course, as height is increasing, wind pressure is increasing. I've included the next two or three slides are looking at, give a diagrammatic understanding of wind behavior on the windward side and the leeward side of a building. On the leeward side, which is the non-windward side, we get what are called wind shadows, which are areas that are buffered from wind. And those shadows can be calculated. There's a formula, a basic formula, that gives a sense of the ratio between building width and extent of wind shadow. So that'll be useful, again, for assignment one. You can, gauge the extent of a wind shadow from your building by knowing its basic dimensions and looking at this formula. And you can also use sectional information to tell you the same thing. So basically, depending on the height of the building, the extent of that wind shadow will change. Just looking at these formulas now, as wind, as obviously as the building gets taller, its impact is greater, okay? So I've included these just for your general reference when you do get to the point of designing some built configuration on site. You can refer back to these to get a general sense of the extent of the wind shadow that's cast on the leeward side of the building. And this set of diagrams also gives a sense of how orientation of building in relation to wind flow impacts the extent and nature of those wind shadows. A lot of this is it's sort of intuitive to a point, but again, because wind is a fluid, it's not as straightforward as tracking sun shadows. So these diagrams will be useful to you when you get to that point. And then one other point about wind modification, which has to do with materiality, is that depending on the permeability of a windbreak, by windbreak I mean some kind of vertical intervention in a landscape, whether that's a row of trees or a fence that might be permeable or impermeable, depending on the level of permeability of that surface, it does have an impact on the extent of the windbreak itself. Basically, what you see is that solid barriers will decrease wind speeds more quickly, but the extent of their wind shadow is less extreme than permeable windbreaks. So keep that in mind when you're designing to impact microclimate on your site in Edinburgh. So the second variable that I'll cover is just solar radiation, which is, we talked a lot about solar mitigation in the context of designing in hot, arid climate zones. In the case of Edinburgh, of course, we want to encourage solar gain. And in fact, we often in temperate climate zones, we talk about wanting to encourage passive heating through solar radiation in the winter, but not in the summer. But because of the climate conditions of Edinburgh, it's in fact beneficial year round. Solar gain is beneficial year round. So that's something to keep in mind when you're designing. There are three forms of solar radiation, which is short wave radiation as opposed to long wave radiation, which is terrestrial radiation. We'll touch on that in a second. Those three forms are the direct radiation from the sun, which travels in parallel lines, which casts shadows. The second is reflected radiation. So that's radiation that's been reflected off of surfaces, building surfaces, ground surfaces, vegetative surfaces, and then diffuse radiation, which is radiation that's just been sort of scattered by particles in the atmosphere. When we talk about designing with solar radiation in mind, the things we want to take into account are the surface material characteristics, and that is related to those issues of emissivity, transmittance, reflectance, absorbance that we talked about last week in the hot, arid climate zone. Basically, those different surface characteristics have to do with how much of that radiation is either absorbed or transmitted through or re-radiated back into the atmosphere. The presence or absence of water is another important variable to take into account. Why is that? Why would it matter? Why would water matter when we talk about solar radiation? Evaporative cooling, right? So certain amounts of solar energy will go towards the process of evaporation, which has a cooling effect, which we want in a hot, arid climate zone. But do we want that in Edinburgh? No. So how water, we're in a rainy climate, we don't want a lot of water on surfaces.
So that that's just an important point about drainage, how important it is to drain paved surfaces appropriately. This project is actually intentionally meant to collect water and show pools of water as a way of registering weather conditions, but that's not, and it's a nice idea and it might be appropriate for that particular climate, but it's something we wouldn't necessarily want to do here in Edinburgh. Terrestrial radiation is the radiation, long-wave radiation, that's emitted by objects on Earth. It's invisible, but it's measurable as temperature. And this again goes back to these surface properties of materials. When the radiation arrives on a surface, it's dealt with in some way. And if it is re-radiated, it's re-radiated as terrestrial radiation. Most vegetative surfaces absorb almost all of the terrestrial radiation they receive. Little is reflected or transmitted. So if we look at this project here, which I'll talk a little bit more about next week, we can think about all of the incoming radiation and how it's distributed to different materials, which of those materials would be absorbing that radiation versus re-radiating it, which would feel cooler versus warmer, which is ultimately what's at stake in Edinburgh. We would want to select materials that would absorb and re-radiate that heat. So surfaces like stone that have thermal mass, concrete, et cetera, gravel to a certain extent, are going to be more beneficial in terms of warming adjacent surfaces than something like vegetation, grass, shrubs, et cetera. So keep surface material characteristics in mind when you are designing your project. Just by altering a paving material alone can go a long way towards improving thermal comfort in an area. So we've touched on these things already, just to reiterate, how would, now knowing what you know about the climate in Edinburgh, what would you recommend in terms of, what are some design principles you would recommend for designing here in terms of wind modification, solar radiation, and material selection? Let's start with wind. What would you recommend doing in terms of siting a building in relation to prevailing wind direction? Would you want it to be bombarded by wind? Would you want it to be buffered by wind? Yeah, so you'd want to site a building. I'm just thinking about the context of designing in George Square Gardens, for example, where you have a number of open spaces. How would you go about selecting a site in George Square in relation to wind flow? You'd probably want to select an area that was buffered from wind, and buffered from wind coming from which direction?
Southwest,
right. How might you do that? Imagine that there is a fair bit of wind coming through. How might you, through design, alter that wind flow?
Walls and stuff like that around.
Wind breaks, right? So walls or lines of trees, those sorts of things, can alter the direction of wind flow. In terms of solar radiation, would you want to mitigate solar radiation? Would you want to reduce the amount of solar radiation on any surface? No. So you'd want to encourage as much solar radiation as possible. And how would material selection impact that? Right. That's right. So you'd want to pick materials that have the capacity, thermal mass capacity, to absorb heat and re-radiate it. And by doing that, again, you can benefit from extended seasonal occupation of a site. And tomorrow what we'll do is we'll look at a number of graphic techniques for testing these conditions in Edinburgh. So hopefully you now have a sense of some of these general principles and how they might be applied. Tomorrow we'll look at specific methods for testing, drawing, and modeling these conditions.
We have a few extra, this is a reminder to bring tomorrow your model, the stereographic sun chart, a torch, and your laptop. And if you have an iPhone, download the Wind Tunnel Pro app. We'll look at all of those things tomorrow. One thing I forgot, but we'll do this tomorrow. I have a list that I'd like you to fill in your microclimate pavilion groups so that we have record of that. I'll send this around tomorrow. So if you haven't selected your groups, please do so today so that we can have a confirmed list tomorrow. Does anybody have any questions? Yeah, Ola. Okay, right. So a reminder about attendance. We are required to keep attendance for various reasons, and to that end, tomorrow we'll be sending around an attendance sheet. And we may do that on lecture days, we may do that on tutorial days, but this week we'll send them around on tutorial days. So that's also to encourage your attendance. Anything else? No?
Shadows cast, it's scaleless in a way.
So any scale works. Doesn't matter. I would recommend making it about that big. The stereographic sun chart, is that what you mean?
Yeah.
I would make that it about that big.
Okay.
And the model about that big.
Okay.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay, thanks. I'll send it around tomorrow in tutorials. I meant to send it during the lecture today and just forgot. Yeah.
I was just wondering, does it need to be in the same
room? It's good if you can do that, just because it helps us manage you. We have those lists already.
Okay. I'm
sorry?
Is it group of three?
I think we said 2 to 4. Just read the assignment and confirm that. Yeah. Thank you. Keep them coming. No, no, it's good. It's good. It's good. No, 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 it's good. I would reread the assignment, but I'm pretty sure it says 2 to 4. Unless I don't think I changed it this year, so about up to 4. Yeah. Did you find it?
Something I was asking about, you know, for product design, they haven't put anything up on Learn so far, so I don't really know what it's supposed to be. There's no information about our course up there.
So you don't know where it.
Oh, no, I've been there.
Okay.
And but he kept on saying that online they're going to have this information about what they're doing, and there's nothing.
I can't really help you with that.
Oh, okay.
I would talk to the course organizer.
Okay.
I mean, I suppose if it becomes an ongoing problem, I can maybe send an email to the course organizer for you, but I would try to
sort
it. Oh, so
it's not in your area? Okay.
No, no, no. I only deal with Learn in the courses that I run.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, yeah. So,
okay, thanks.
Thank goodness. I can't imagine having to deal with Learn in every course. Yes. Oh, okay. I wouldn't buy it. Just get take the free one. Yeah, yeah. Yeah, okay.
I can't wait.